Alphabetically speaking, John, Unsworth, you're up.
Okay.
Yes, we have. Pass these around, too.
I have them, right?
Yeah. It's two pages. That was probably neatly organized before I just picked it up.
Every two.
Oh, every two, okay. So every two, it is neatly organized, but it's just not straight. It's going to drive me insane, so I got to fix that.
Just go to the second slide. So while the handout's going around, I'll get started.
That's great.
Like David, I didn't come through an LIS program. My alums were frequently reminding me when I started this job. But I have come to think that they're maybe the most likely departmental home for digital humanities in institutions where they exist. Also, like everybody else in this room, I think I have several perspectives on the topics of hiring and promotion in what I will call the DH terrarium. All those academic departments, libraries, digital humanities centers, professional organizations, projects, etc. So I've hired programmers, designers,
hey, business John, managers. Sorry, could you pick up just a little bit? We're getting not picking you up.
I've hired programmers, designers, business managers, project managers, assistant and associate deans, center directors, assistant and associate directors, development staff, communication staff, instructional technology staff, sysadmins, help desk staff, research computing staff, research scientists, HR people, administrative support staff, and various kinds of faculty, including visiting faculty, research faculty, adjunct faculty, and tenure track faculty, and have worked with volunteers, hardest of all. my perspective is also shaped by having been hired, and I have been hired as a grad assistant, a teaching assistant, a research assistant, a lecturer, a junior faculty member, a consultant, a senior faculty member, and an administrator. And I'm leaving out some things that might not seem as relevant as they actually are, like paperboy, babysitter, groundskeeper, bartender, waiter, salesperson, liquor store guy, secretary, computer support person, bike mechanic, furniture mover, first mate, cabbie, limo driver, nurse's aide, mental health worker, and tutor for the criminally insane. No, I think that's pretty comprehensive.
How much of that was just parent to make
Yeah.
So as an employee, I've learned a lot about people and eventually about organizations and how they interact. And some of those interactions are difficult. For much of the time that I've been an employee, it's actually been part of my job to be an employer. And in that role, I've fired people who were corrosive to the organization. I've counseled people into positions for which they're better suited and out of positions that they really didn't fit. My least favorite, I've laid off people because we couldn't afford them. But I've also worked with people at all levels, from civil service to university administration, as they try to advance some shared project at the same time that they try to advance their individual professional goals. I've made some good hires. I've made some not so good hires. It is something that I like to think I'm getting better at as time goes on. And one of the things I've learned is that when you're hiring, you screen a two-dimensional representation of a person. But in the end, you hire the whole three-dimensional person. You get all the experience that was on the CV, and you get all the experience that wasn't, the babysitter, tutor for the criminally insane, etc. You get their home life. You get their health, you get their past bosses and all the mistakes that they made, you get their hopes for the future. And in my experience, although we've been talking a lot about titles and stations and salaries, those things do matter, but they actually matter a lot more if you're not satisfied with your work, if you haven't internalized the mission, or if you don't like the people you're working with. I've also learned a couple of other things. Very important, nobody wants to think that they are bad at their job. And even if they fear that they might be, they don't want to think it. And everyone, or almost everyone, there might be one or two exceptions to this one, wants to get better at something. So my point for our purposes here is that we do have to hire according to job descriptions that fit the employment categories given in our institutional context, and that's what the links on this slide are for, to lead you to descriptions of categories either in my school or in my university, so you can compare them to your own and see if any interesting differences emerge. Whatever the categories, though, we always hire people who are broader than their job descriptions, and that's true no matter what level you're talking about. And the real goal, I think, of faculty, staff, and professional development consists of finding ways to make the most out of all the things that people bring to the table, and that usually means thinking well beyond the job description. So the people we employ, and that includes students that we work with, also need opportunities to develop. And in a very simple way, one of the things we've talked about earlier in the day here is funding for professional development that comes as part of our job. At GISLIS, we offer professional development funds for students, for staff, and for all kinds of faculty. And because I'm fairly egalitarian, everybody gets the same deal, up to $1,000 a year. There are different conditions, though. If you're a student, you have to have a paper accepted at a peer-reviewed conference in order to put in a request for this funding. Staff can request it if they're doing elective professional development as opposed to things that they're assigned to do as part of their job. Adjuncts, who might teach one course a year for us, for example, have a prorated access to this kind of funding where we consider four courses a year to be full-time. So if you taught one course a year, you could ask for $250, Julia.
Okay.
If you taught two, you could ask for $500. And this is all up on our policy section on our website. Faculty can use this for any kind of professional travel, but they're asked to use their startup funds or their grant funds before they request the department funds. And actually, we've been able to preserve this even through the budget disasters that we've been through in the last several years. And I think it's very important for an organization to project itself out into things like professional meetings. It means a lot when, you know, you go to a conference, the ACIST conference, which is a big one in the library science field, or the Digital Humanities Conference, and you see tons of people from Illinois. It gives an impression that, you know, the place is strong, that there's a lot going on there. I think it's money very well spent, both in terms of professional development and in terms of marketing. People also need honest feedback about how to do better and how they're doing. So for junior faculty, we do annual reviews by the executive committee, and I write those up for each of them. We do a very serious third-year review with a specially appointed faculty committee, which is really a dress rehearsal for the tenure submission in year six. And once a semester before tenure, they meet individually with me and one or more of my associate deans to talk about their publication plans, where they are in those plans, and any impediments to progress that we could remove. So sometimes people will go a long time with a problem that you could fix, but they don't want to ask you. You know, they don't want to be a nuisance. Meanwhile, you know, their clock is ticking and something's not getting done. So we make sure we ask about those things. And beyond that, the whole human being, whether that's a tenure-track human being or not, needs feedback on what they do well, what they don't do well, where they fit, what futures they might project for themselves. Because they do get distracted by categories. And they sometimes think they want what they're supposed to want, even if they really don't want to do what's involved in being that or getting that. So can we turn the recording off for a moment?
Yes, hang on.
So with those generalities in mind, I wanted to look at the description of research faculty that I handed out. Bethany, in the notes on Google Docs this meeting, raised the question about whether research faculty was a good category of employment to promote, but also, I think, indicated this might vary by institution. Mm-hmm. Personally, I see this category and the related category of research scientists as potentially very interesting and useful for digital humanities. And I'm not going to go through the whole document. I'll just flag a couple things. One is, under the second heading, research faculty at the University of Illinois in general, the university leaves much up to the individual units in figuring out guidelines and policies for using, for defining these roles and using people in these roles. The university recently issued a report about revenue generation that talks about the role that research professors and research scientists can play in helping to bring in revenue, and they used examples from the School of Social Work and the College of Engineering in talking about that. That's a public report which you can get, Google Stewarding Excellence, University of Illinois, and the project team on revenue generation. You'll find their report there. Then on the second page, this is our conceptualization of research faculty, comparable in responsibilities, achievement, and stature in the field. The tenure system faculty, they have full privileges accorded to tenure system faculties by the bylaws, with the following exceptions. They don't vote on issues involving promotion and tenure. They don't serve on the executive committee, although they may vote in the executive committee elections, and so on. You can read that. We have information further down about the target allocations of time: 60% funded research, 20% teaching, 10% service, 10% other research. Other research is basically the work that you do to cultivate new projects that haven't yet been funded. Funding comes from different sources, and to the extent that they teach, some funding comes from the instructional budget and from tuition, then other kinds of money comes from other sources depending on the nature of the activity. And there is information here about promotion and so on. And we have three levels of research faculty: assistant, associate, full, basically. So I think those are worth thinking about, and it's worth looking at examples. Earlier in the day, somebody mentioned the sciences and research scientists, I think, came up in that connection. And this is also something that most universities understand, although they don't usually understand it. They haven't encountered it in the context of the humanities. But it is a category that they, you know, they can deal with. So that's most of it. Just a couple unrelated remarks for people running DH centers or thinking about doing so. Things that I've learned after leaving one and sort of reflecting back from what I'm doing now. One is that direct involvement in the educational enterprise, for example, running an undergraduate major or running a graduate program, puts you close to the core business of the university. And it connects you to an income stream that, especially in public universities these days, supports everything else. But it may also put you in the line of fire from other units who could regard you as siphoning off their students and their tuition. It's worth it, though, if it fits with your other plans. Failing that, if you're not going to embed yourself in the educational enterprise, you do need to be sure that you have a constituency and it consists of people who are going to be vocal in support of you and who get listened to. And to my mind, that's one of the strengths of the faculty fellow model, although I realize there are plenty of problems with the faculty fellow model. But one thing it does is that it develops a constituency that grows over time and that consists of people who have a voice that gets heard in the institution. And finally, DH centers have rationales that administrators often find compelling. You can help fund humanities graduate students, something nobody knows how to do. You can help retain senior faculty and rising stars who get involved in your projects because it makes it hard for them to take their projects somewhere else. You can help to cultivate a culture of grant-funded work where one doesn't exist. That's relevant to supporting graduate students. And you can provide an interdisciplinary meeting place for researchers that doesn't exist in very many other parts of the university. So DH centers do have very real challenges when it comes to professional development for their own employees. We shouldn't overlook the resource that they constitute for the professional development of graduate students and faculty, and in many cases, professional development for staff working elsewhere in the university who move into these centers and find this a real opportunity to grow. So that doesn't solve the problem within the DH center. But don't forget you're solving somebody else's problems along the way.
I'm going to